Have you ever noticed how the exact policies or, the institutions that are designed to save the world are usually the ones that end up quietly destroying it?
Oh, absolutely. It's a pattern that repeats constantly.
Right. Like you see this massive global initiative launched to, say, eradicate poverty or maybe deploy a new technology to heal the environment. And
And then a
then,
decade later, you look around and the cure is the disease.
yes. Exactly. The cure has somehow weaponized itself. It becomes this deeply entrenched part of the problem. We invent these correctives to save us, and well, they end up capturing us instead.
Which is, the ultimate paradox of human intervention. I mean, we approach these huge civilizational crises assuming that if we just find the right framework, the right
Or the
metric,
right technological hammer.
right, we think we can just fix the machine of society. But, and this is the crux of it, society is not a machine.
It's a living system.
Exactly, it's a living system. And when you apply these rigid mechanical fixes to living systems, the results are, well, they're almost always disastrous.
And that is exactly why we are here today. We know you, our listener, you're someone who really wants to understand the architecture beneath the headlines, right?
You're not satisfied with just treating the symptoms.
Yeah, exactly. You want to know why those symptoms keep coming back? Just, wearing new disguises?
Yeah.
So today, we are taking a deep dive into this incredibly dense, just brilliant white paper.
It really is a paradigm-shifting piece of work.
It is by Dr. Bechara-Sehely, and it's titled Keeping Life Coherence Alive, A Maturin and Reflection on Distinction, Capture, and the Mythic Traps of Civilizational Repair. I mean, quite a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, yeah. But Dr. Sahili brings this fascinating synthesis to the problem. I mean, he's a physician.
Which is an interesting background for this, right?
Right, because he's trained to look at living organisms and systemic health, but he applies that exact lens to planetary governance.
Wow.
And to do this, he bridges fields that historically they just have nothing to say to one another. He pulls from Humberto Maturana's Biology of Cognition.
Which we'll definitely get into.
Yeah, and he layers that with systems theory. And then, maybe most surprisingly, he uses ancient Greek and Roman mythology.
Which I love.
Right. He uses it as this diagnostic grammar for modern human failure.
Oh, yeah.
It gives us a completely new way of seeing how we govern the world.
Okay, so let's start with this central concept of the paper, life coherence. Now, I will admit, the first time I saw that term, my cynical brain just immediately flagged it as like a corporate buzzword.
Oh, completely. It sounds like ESG jargon.
Right. It sounds like something a massive conglomerate puts on their annual sustainability brochure, like right next to the word synergy.
Yeah, and the paper actually anticipates that exact reaction because the danger of life coherence becoming a buzzword is the very thing the author is warning us against.
Okay, that makes sense. So, what does it actually mean then?
Well, as a diagnostic tool, life coherence asks a really specific ground-level question. It asks, does a pattern of action or a policy or a technology, does it preserve, restore, and expand the conditions under which life can flourish?
So, it forces our attention completely away from abstract data points.
Exactly. It doesn't care if GDP went up.
Or if some compliance quota was met. It forces us to look at, actual living consequences, like are human bodies healthier?
Are the rivers toxic?
Right. Are communities capable of self-determination? But the core tension here that we're exploring today is that even a concept as noble as life coherence is incredibly dangerous if we're not careful.
It's dangerous because to understand why our solutions fail, we have to first understand the mechanics of how we create the world through the distinctions we make.
Which brings us to this foundational problem he calls corrective capture.
Yes, corrective capture. This happens when a movement or an institution, one that was born to repair a life-destroying pattern, it begins to conserve itself more strongly than the life it was meant to serve.
Okay, let's really unpack this because this is huge. What are the actual mechanics of a framework stopping its mission to serve life and like pivoting to just serve itself?
Well, it really comes down to institutional gravity. When a corrective idea is born, say, a grassroots environmental movement, it starts with this genuine focus on living ecosystems.
Right, people just want to save the forest.
Exactly. But to scale that idea, you have to institutionalize it. You need funding, you need a headquarters.
Staff, HR departments.
Yes, compliance metrics, a specialized vocabulary. And over time, the survival of the institution and the purity of that vocabulary, they become the primary concern.
The language stays the same, though, right?
Oh, the language is identical. They still claim they're fighting for the environment, But functionally, the institution is now filtering all of its decisions through the lens of its own continuity.
I keep thinking about an analogy here. It's like, imagine a person who gets a terrifying medical diagnosis, right?
Yeah.
They realize their lifestyle is killing them, so they adopt this strict life-giving diet to heal.
Okay, yeah.
The goal is entirely about restoring their capacity for life.
Yeah.
But over the course of, say, 5 years, they become obsessively fixated on the rules of the diet.
They lose the forest for the trees.
Exactly. They start weighing every single grain of rice. They refuse to eat anything they haven't grown themselves. They isolate themselves from their friends and family because social situations might compromise their dietary purity.
Wow, yeah. So the diet morphs into a severe eating disorder.
Yes. The original goal, which was health, is completely obliterated by the rigid, institutionalized enforcement of the method they invented to achieve it.
That is a perfect analogy. The method eats the mission. And the biological and sociological theory underpinning this phenomenon, it comes from Humberto Maturana.
A Chilean biologist.
Right, Chilean biologist and philosopher. His work is really the bedrock for Dr. Saheli's paper. And Maturana posited this core axiom: everything said is said by an observer.
Everything said is said by an observer. I mean, that sounds kind of obvious on the surface.
It does, but it's profound because it completely destroys the idea that we can have this objective view from nowhere perspective when we're trying to solve global problems.
It undermines the whole classical scientific assumption that we're just these detached spectators, right? Like we're just registering pre-existing categories in the world.
Exactly. Maturana argued that human beings are embodied organisms. So the distinctions we make, the categories we create, the labels we apply, they don't just describe the world. They bring forth a specific domain of action.
Okay, let's ground that for the listener. Give me an example of what bringing forth this domain of action looks like.
Sure. Think about when a governing body looks at a piece of land. If they categorize it as untapped resources versus categorizing it as sacred ancestral territory.
Oh, wow. Yeah. They aren't just slapping different post-it notes on the same objective reality.
No, they are authorizing entirely different realities.
Yeah.
To make a distinction is to make some actions possible and to make other actions completely invisible or even illegal.
Right. So if you distinguish a forest primarily as timber, that linguistic distinction brings forth an entire world of extraction, heavy machinery, supply chains, economic valuation.
But if you distinguish that exact same forest as a vital carbon sink and living ecosystem, you bring forth a world of conservation, biological study, protective legislation.
So a distinction is never innocent.
Never. It is an active participant in creating the reality we live in.
And this leads right into Maturana's concept of structural coupling, right? This idea that an organism and its environment are constantly triggering changes in each other over time.
Yes, but humans do this structural coupling through language and emotion.
Through emotion, not just reason.
That's the key. In Maturana's framework, language isn't just a system of communication, it's our manner of living together. But language always rests upon an emotional ground. We tend to view rational thought as something that, you know, floats above the messy world of emotions.
Right, like reason is objective and emotion is subjective.
Maturana argues the exact opposite. Reason unfolds within an emotional domain. The emotion dictates what you even consider relevant enough to apply your reason toward in the first place.
This means the exact same vocabulary, the exact same policy proposal, can have completely different consequences in the real world depending on the emotional posture of the people implementing it.
Spot on. Consider the concept of repair. If you approach a civilizational crisis with a genuine emotional ground of care,
meaning you recognize the other person or the ecosystem as a legitimate entity.
Exactly, a legitimate entity in coexistence with you. If you act from care, your actions will seek to restore life capacity. But if you approach that same crisis from an emotional ground of superiority or fear or ambition,
and the language of repair just functions as a mechanism for domination.
The paper explicitly maps this out. It states that life coherence spoken from a foundation of fear inevitably turns into surveillance.
Wow.
And life coherence spoken from anger transforms into punishment. And if it's spoken from institutional ambition, it just becomes another form of capture.
So you could have the most beautifully designed, scientifically backed environmental policy in the world. But if the state enforces it out of a desire for absolute control, it literally ceases to be life coherent.
Which really forces us to rethink the very nature of our crises. The traditional view is that we're suffering from material shortages, right? A lack of energy, a lack of food, an excess of carbon.
Dr. Saheli argues that our crises are fundamentally crises of can serve distinctions.
Yes. We're trapped in life-destroying patterns because our inherited categories, our economic language, and our legal definitions make those destructive patterns seem completely rational. They make them seem necessary.
Because if a distinction shapes reality, treating life coherence as some fixed doctrine is a massive trap. The moment we write down the definitive 10-point plan for how to be life coherent, we've created a rigid framework.
And a rigid framework is exactly what gets captured by an institution. A doctrine demands purity. It seeks final certainty, and it judges the world from an external, supposedly objective viewpoint.
So to escape this corrective capture, we have to transition from a static doctrine to what the author calls living discernment.
Living discernment, meaning a living distinction remains forever answerable to the consequences it produces in the physical world.
And to maintain this living discernment, the paper outlines these three paired commitments. Let's go through them. The first is clarity without domination.
Right. Because ambiguity often protects systemic harm. If we can't clearly name an extractive or violent practice, we can't interrupt it.
We need to call a spade a spade.
We do. However, the purpose of that clarity is to halt the destruction. It is not to conquer or annihilate the human beings who are caught inside that destructive pattern.
Okay, then the second commitment is commitment without certainty. And honestly, this one feels deeply counterintuitive.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we are so conditioned to believe that strong commitment requires absolute unwavering certainty. If you're not certain, you're weak.
But certainty is the death of adaptability. In living systems, holding your values deeply means you must never place your methods beyond revision.
Let life correct you.
Exactly. If your commitment to preserving life is genuine, you have to allow life to correct you.
Right.
If you design this brilliant agricultural policy that looks perfect on a whiteboard,
but it ends up starving a local community.
Right. Then your commitment to life dictates that you abandon the certainty of your whiteboard model. You have to adapt.
Which flows perfectly into the third commitment, repair without purity.
Because we live in a historical world, not a theoretical one, living systems carry the scars of injury, of trauma, of past errors.
Nothing is pristine.
Nothing. So a framework that demands absolute moral purity before it allows you to participate in repair, that's a framework that stalls progress.
Purity divides the world into the righteous who hold the correct vocabulary and the condemned who don't.
It's toxic.
And this draws a massive line between performance and repair.
Oh, let's talk about that.
Performance is administrative. It asks, did we use the accepted language? Does this initiative align with our quarterly reporting metrics?
Whereas repair is visceral.
Very visceral. Repair asks, is the soil actually regenerating? Are the people in this neighborhood actually breathing cleaner air?
So performance is an exercise in life control, treating life as an object to be shaped and managed.
And measured against a predetermined ideal. Care, conversely, is an exercise in life coherence. It participates in cultivating the specific, localized conditions where life can renew itself autonomously.
Okay, I need to challenge this, though. Let's play devil's advocate.
Please do.
If we completely abandon doctrine, right? If we discard fixed metrics and pure standards in favor of this fuzzy concept of living discernment, don't we just collapse into total relativism?
I see where you're going.
Like, I can easily imagine a massive petrochemical company looking at this framework and saying, well, since there are no rigid rules, our deep sea drilling operation is totally life coherent because it provides jobs and economic stability for thousands of families.
Mm.
How do we stop the concept from being weaponized by the very people causing the harm?
It is a vital pushback. But the paper resolves it through what we call relational realism, not relativism.
Relational realism. Okay, explain that.
A distinction is never life coherent merely because someone invokes the name of life. It is only life coherent in the actual measurable living world it brings forth.
So the physical consequences speak back.
Exactly. The petrochemical company can use the vocabulary of life coherence all they want in their press releases. But the physical consequences of their actions, the acidification of the ocean, the asthma rates in neighboring communities, the displacement of indigenous populations, those realities speak back.
So living discernment actually requires extreme rigor.
It is far more demanding than a static doctrine because you can't hide behind compliance. You can't just check a box. You are constantly judged by the living results of your actions.
Okay, so to maintain that extreme rigor, we need a way to diagnose when our institutions, and honestly our own minds, are drifting away from those living consequences and back toward rigid doctrine.
And this is where the paper provides a diagnostic grammar to spot this drift. And it does so by resurrecting ancient mythology.
Which is just such a cool approach.
Dr. Saley treats these myths not as archaic folklore, but as conserved civilizational diagnostics.
They map out the precise ways that our necessary human functions, like our ability to measure, to warn, to speak, to build, lose their answerability to life. They turn into self-conserving traps.
Let's dive into these mythic traps. The first grouping deals with mind, measurement, and language. And the very first trap is Procrustes.
Right. So in the myth, Procrustes was this innkeeper who offered a bed to weary travelers. But if the traveler was too short for the bed, he would stretch their limbs on a rack until they fit. And if they were too tall, he would amputate their legs.
It is a horrifying image.
Truly horrifying. But the diagnostic horror isn't just the physical violence, it's the inversion of fit.
Yes, the inversion of fit. The bed is treated as an absolute unquestionable reality. And the living, breathing human body is treated as raw material that just has to be mutilated to conform to the metric.
And we see the Procrustes trap constantly in modern society. I mean, think about our educational system.
Perfect example.
We invent standardized tests as a metric to measure learning, which is fine initially. But over time, the test becomes the Procrustean bed. Schools cut funding for arts, for music, for recess. Teachers are forced to teach strictly to the test.
We stretch and amputate the natural chaotic curiosity of a child's mind to force them to fit the metric.
The measure becomes the master.
Or look at how we handle global ecology. We recognize that carbon emissions are a massive problem, right? So we develop complex carbon accounting metrics.
But if we fall into the Procrustes trap,
we reduce the infinite living complexity of a biosphere solely to a carbon spreadsheet. You might see a corporation clear-cut a diverse, ancient, old-growth forest just to plant a monoculture of genetically modified, fast-growing trees.
Because on paper, the monoculture sequesters carbon faster.
Exactly. The metric is satisfied, but the life capacity of the ecosystem is mutilated.
Wow. Okay, the next diagnostic is the Cassandra trap. Now, Cassandra was blessed with the ability to see the future, but she was cursed so that no one would ever believe her warnings.
This represents the trap of warning. It occurs when a society possesses the truth, they see the data, they even hear the alarm bells, but they completely fail to operationally receive it.
The warning never converts into structural action.
Never.
It's the equivalent of driving down the highway, seeing the check engine light flashing red on your dashboard, hearing the engine knocking, and deciding the best course of action is to just put a piece of black electrical tape over the light.
Out of sight, out of mind.
You possess the information. You know there's a critical failure. But you lack the capacity to let that information actually change your trajectory.
And the crucial insight here is why systems ignore the warning. It is rarely due to a lack of data or simple ignorance.
It's intentional.
Systems ignore Cassandra because fully receiving her warning would require the system to relinquish power. It would require them to interrupt profitable harm or completely dismantle their incumbent infrastructure.
The fossil fuel industry is the classic example here.
The absolute classic. They possessed accurate climate modeling decades ago. They were in the Cassandra trap not because they couldn't read the data, but because acting on the data meant ending their own dominance.
Right. Then we have the Narcissus trap. Narcissus fell so deeply in love with his own reflection in a pool of water that he withered away and died staring at himself.
The trap of identity.
A system falls into the Narcissus trap when its self-image replaces its living answerability. The institution becomes, like, obsessed with curating its moral brand while avoiding real-world accountability.
This perfectly describes modern corporate greenwashing.
Oh, 100%. A massive multinational corporation will spend tens of millions of dollars on a beautifully produced, emotionally manipulative ad campaign showcasing their commitment to clean water.
They fall in love with their reflection, their ESG branding.
Meanwhile, their actual material footprint involves dumping industrial waste into rivers in the global south. The image completely replaces the encounter with reality.
It's tragic. And moving to language, we encounter the Babel trap. The myth of the Tower of Babel describes a moment where humanity is suddenly fractured by different languages, leading to the collapse of their massive architectural project.
We generally think of Babel as an inability to communicate because people literally don't share a vocabulary, but the paper frames it differently.
It does. The Babel trap happens when shared words no longer bring forth shared worlds.
Semantic collapse.
Yes. People can be speaking the exact same language, using the exact same terminology, but mutual intelligibility has vanished.
This is the defining characteristic of modern political discourse.
Oh, completely.
You can have two opposing political factions standing in a town hall, both passionately screaming the words, freedom, justice, and security.
But the reality that Faction A uses freedom to authorize is completely incompatible with the reality Faction B uses freedom to authorize.
They agree on the phonetic sounds coming out of their mouths, but nothing else.
Which serves as a stark warning for planetary governance. Agreement in vocabulary does not equal agreement in reality.
You can get 150 nations to sign a treaty committing to sustainable development.
But if you haven't done the rigorous work of defining the world that phrase brings forth, the treaty is just a babble trap. Whose development? Sustaining what? At whose expense?
Man, that is chilling. Okay, so as we transition from the traps of mind and language to the traps of power and intervention, the scale of the danger really increases. Let's look at the Phaethon and Icarus traps.
Both myths feature characters who gain access to flight but lack the discipline to control it, resulting in catastrophic crashes.
This is the trap of capability.
It manifests when a civilization's technological power and speed drastically outrun its emotional, ethical, and institutional maturity.
Right. Just because we have the capability to split the atom or edit the human genome or deploy autonomous drone swarms,
it does not mean we possess the wisdom to bear the consequences of those actions.
We are basically handing the keys to a fighter jet to an emotionally volatile teenager.
That's exactly what we're doing. Next is the Trojan horse trap, the ancient symbol of the deceptive gift. In systems theory, this is the trap of reform.
The trap of reform. How so?
It occurs when an intervention uses corrective language or the appearance of assistance to smuggle old power dynamics into a new paradigm.
Green colonialism is a prime example of this, isn't it?
Oh, perfect example. A wealthy nation offers a massive investment package to a developing nation to build solar farms and transition their energy grid. On the surface, it is a corrective gift.
But the terms of the investment require the developing nation to extract and export their rare earth minerals at predatory prices.
While plunging them into insurmountable debt, the corrective language of a clean energy transition just smuggles in the exact same extractive power dynamic that has existed for centuries.
So sneaky. And closely related are the Hydra and Sisyphus traps. The Hydra was a monster that grew two new heads every time one was chopped off. Sisyphus was condemned to push a boulder up a mountain for eternity, only to watch it roll back down.
You might wonder why we group these two together.
Yeah, why?
Because together they describe the modern institutional treadmill. The Hydra trap is the trap of intervention. It happens when we violently attack the visible manifestations of a problem while fiercely conserving the generative source pattern that creates the problem in the first place.
We absolutely love chopping off heads.
We do. Head chopping is highly visible, it looks heroic, and crucially, it gets funded.
Right. Like, we will build a multi-billion dollar public health apparatus to treat the staggering rise of chronic respiratory diseases in an urban center. We are treating the manifestation.
But we completely ignore the zoning laws that placed highly polluting industrial facilities right next to low-income housing.
We leave the generative source pattern entirely untouched.
And this traps us in the Sisyphus dynamic. Endless effort replacing structural conversion.
You can have incredibly dedicated people pushing the boulder. They're exhausted, they're sweating, they're publishing annual reports, they're holding global summits. The activity is very real.
But because they refuse to alter the structural conditions of the mountain itself, the boulder always rolls back down.
Activity does not equal change.
It really doesn't. Which brings us to perhaps the most devastating mechanism of civilizational drift. The Kronos trap.
Kronos
was the titan who, terrified of losing his supremacy, devoured his own children as soon as they were born.
The trap of continuity.
It occurs when a present system, desperate to preserve its incumbent arrangements of power and wealth, sustains itself by consuming its own future.
It is the literal consumption of the next generation. We see the Kronos trap in how we manage ecological stability, we deplete global biodiversity, we poison the aquifers, and we pump gigatons of carbon into the atmosphere just to maintain the quarterly profits of our current economic engine.
We saddle the unborn with massive unpayable financial debt to bail out failing institutions today.
The present devours the future.
A truly life-coherent society would be structurally required to make future generations present in their judgment today. But our current systems are structurally incentivized to do the exact opposite.
Okay. The final two traps in this category deal with tools and foresight, the oracle and the golem.
The oracle trap occurs when we treat forecasts, risk models, or algorithmic projections as inevitable fate. Instead of viewing a grim projection as an urgent invitation to intervene and change course, we view it as destiny.
We just accept it.
Yes. And the golem trap is the trap of tools. In folklore, the golem is an artificial being created from clay to serve its maker.
But it lacks a soul.
It lacks a soul, it lacks living discernment, and inevitably it grows out of control, mindlessly pursuing its encoded purpose.
So when you combine the Oracle and the golem, you get the absolute nightmare scenario of modern artificial intelligence in governance and warfare.
Exactly. Imagine an AI system, the golem, that is mathematically optimized for military lethality or economic extraction.
It processes vast amounts of data and generates a projection, the Oracle.
If human leaders treat that algorithmic projection as unquestionable truth, completely bypassing human ethical judgment, the tool has conquered the creator.
A tool that cannot be interrupted by the living reality of human suffering has already begun to dominate the civilization that built it.
That's the terrifying reality.
Okay, so we have mapped out an incredible array of traps. Procrustes mutilating life to fit the metric. Cassandra ignored. Narcissus obsessed with brand. The Trojan horse smuggling exploitation. But the paper builds to one final trap, isolating it as the most dangerous of all, particularly for you, the listener, who actually cares deeply about fixing the world.
The golden calf trap.
The ultimate danger of idolatry.
Yes. In the ancient narrative, Moses goes up the mountain to receive the law. The people below grow terrified by the chaos and uncertainty of waiting. So to soothe their anxiety, they melt down their gold, construct a statue of a calf, and begin to worship the symbol instead of the reality it points to.
This trap occurs when the symbol of life replaces life itself. Is a transformation of life coherence into a slogan, a rigid doctrine, an institution, or a weapon of moral superiority.
The framework itself becomes the idol.
I see this trajectory so often in social movements. A movement will spark into existence from a place of deep, pure desire to end systemic suffering. They develop a framework to explain the injustice. But over the years, the leaders of the movement fall into the golden calf trap.
They start demanding absolute ideological purity.
Yes. They use their specific academic vocabulary as a purity test to excommunicate anyone who deviates slightly from the doctrine. The movement becomes more fiercely dedicated to protecting its theoretical elegance than to actually listening to the marginalized people it claims to represent.
The anti-idolatry principle at the heart of Dr. Salehi's paper is clear. A life-coherent distinction becomes life-incoherent the exact moment it conserves itself more strongly than the life it was introduced to protect.
When you are more concerned with someone using the correct terminology than you are with their actual material suffering, you are worshiping a golden calf.
Beautifully put.
But wait, if certainty and pure doctrine are traps, how do we hold our ground? I mean, there are undeniably life-destroying forces operating in the world, massive systems of extraction and exploitation. If we abandon the certainty of our frameworks, don't we just become weak? Do we lose our ability to fight back?
It's a common fear, but abandoning idolatry is not the same as abandoning clarity. The opposite of the golden calf is not vagueness. The opposite is living answerability.
Living answerability.
We can fiercely refuse to accept violent systems. We can draw absolute lines in the sand against extraction. But our refusal must remain tethered to the living ground, to actual bodies, water, soils. We do not defend our framework. We defend life.
And if our chosen framework ceases to effectively defend life, we must possess the living rigor to tear the framework down and build a new one.
Exactly.
That requires an immense amount of discipline. Because the gravity of institutional ego is always pulling us toward the golden calf, we need a mechanism to protect our correctives from capture.
And the paper proposes a disciplined, recurring practice for this called the recursive life coherence audit.
Now, the word audit implies a sterile bureaucratic checklist, but this is a deeply grounded practice of recurring vigilance.
It's a set of diagnostic inquiries applied simultaneously to the external world and to our own internal motivations. The central question is always, what happens to life when this distinction is used in this specific way?
It functions like the immune system of a good idea. Without the audit, the idea gets infected by the Narcissus trap or the Procrustes trap and becomes a weapon.
The paper lists 10 specific questions. Let's explore how this audit works in real time by applying it to a concept that dominates global policy discussions today, resilience.
A highly complex and frequently weaponized term. The audit begins by asking, what life capacity does this concept reveal?
Right. When we praise a community for its resilience after a devastating hurricane or a massive economic collapse, we are revealing a genuine capacity. We are acknowledging their incredible strength, their adaptability, their ability to survive under immense pressure. It highlights a living truth.
But the audit immediately pivots to the shadow side. What does this concept obscure? Every frame, by making something visible, necessarily hides something else.
And this is where resilience gets dangerous. By intensely focusing the spotlight on how tough the community is, the concept completely obscures the systemic neglect that made them vulnerable to begin with.
It hides the fact that the state failed to build proper levees, or that the economic system stripped them of their safety nets.
Which naturally leads to the next questions of voice. Who gains voice through this framework, and who loses voice?
Local leaders who embody that rugged endurance might gain voice. But the people who are utterly exhausted lose their voice. The individuals who are breaking under the pressure, who are screaming, "We shouldn't have to be this resilient, we need structural support," they are silenced.
Because if the framework has decided that resilience is the highest civic virtue, demanding an end to the trauma is reframed as complaining or weakness.
Moving to the institutional mechanics, what does this framework authorize and what does it prohibit?
It authorizes the state, or massive corporations, to publicly applaud the community's spirit while simultaneously continuing policies of austerity and defunding.
And it prohibits or makes it incredibly difficult to demand structural reparations because the narrative of overcoming adversity has replaced the narrative of systemic injustice.
And here we reach the crux of the institutional threat. What institutions might capture this concept, and what violence could be justified in its name?
This is the question that should be required for every piece of legislation. Resilience is captured by politicians who use it as a shield to justify cutting social welfare programs. They are resilient people. They will figure it out without state funding.
And the violence justified in its name is the structural violence of abandonment. Leaving marginalized populations to fend for themselves during a crisis becomes a matter of public policy, cloaked in the language of empowerment.
The final phase of the audit demands correctability. What would require revision, and does this framework still serve life, or has it begun to serve itself?
If the life expectancy of this resilient community continues to drop, if their infant mortality rate spikes, if their mental health collapses from the sheer biological stress of perpetual survival, those physical metrics must force a revision of our framework.
We have to stop celebrating their endurance and start dismantling the forces crushing them.
If no conceivable amount of human suffering or empirical evidence could make you abandon your chosen framework, you are not operating with a living distinction. You are enforcing a dogma.
Furthermore, the audit is internally facing. The observer must constantly interrogate their own emotional ground. Am I deploying the term resilience from a place of genuine care and solidarity, or am I deploying it from a place of administrative convenience and a desire to avoid accountability?
This practice of rigorous, recurring self-interrogation is what the author calls distinction hygiene. And when we scale distinction hygiene up from the individual to the macro level, we arrive at the profound implications for planetary governance.
Because planetary governance isn't merely the logistical management of treaties and global finance. It is the management of the distinctions we use to make the world intelligible. Let's examine how this applies to climate.
If we practice distinction hygiene on our climate frameworks, we recognize that we have to escape the Procrustes trap of singular carbon counting and the Cassandra trap of ignored data.
Climate is not synonymous with emissions. Climate is a proxy for planetary habitability.
Exactly. A life-coherent climate policy recognizes that the biosphere is a complex web of structural couplings. You cannot solve a crisis of habitability with a mechanical spreadsheet.
But the most radical paradigm shift in the paper centers on security. The author introduces the concept of the Mars-Kronos coupling, arguing that we fundamentally confuse common defense with claim protection. Walk us through the mechanics of that.
The structural mandate of a military or a state security apparatus is almost universally claim protection. It is designed to protect territorial borders, safeguard wealth accumulation, and maintain geopolitical advantage.
Okay, and common defense.
Common defense in a life-coherent framework means protecting shared life capacity, ecological stability, clean water, global public health.
And the conflict arises because claim protection actively destroys common defense.
Yes. A massive superpower might build the most technologically advanced military in human history to protect its territorial borders. But the operation of that military-industrial complex consumes staggering amounts of fossil fuels, diverts trillions of dollars away from ecological repair, and hoards critical resources.
This is the Mars-Kronos coupling. The mechanics of war Mars are sustained by devouring the future Kronos.
A security apparatus that protects the incumbent power of a nation state today by structurally guaranteeing the ecological collapse of the planet tomorrow is profoundly incoherent. It secures the claim, but it annihilates the conditions under which life can continue. It creates a heavily armed, highly fortified, dead world.
We see the same life incoherent inversion in economics. The Midas trap.
Ah, yes. King Midas possessed the capability to turn everything he touched into gold, but he starved to death because human biology cannot metabolize gold. He prioritized the symbol of value over the reality of life.
And our current macroeconomic paradigm is a planetary Midas trap. We operate under the assumption that the economy is the foundational ground of human existence and that life must be subordinated to economic growth.
We will actively degrade living realities. We will clear-cut ancient forests. We will pollute watersheds. We will extract hundreds of hours of unpaid labor from human beings, all to ensure that the abstract metric of gross domestic product continues to rise.
We sacrifice the territory to feed the map. Life coherence demands the complete reversal of this polarity. Life is the ground of the economy. Economic valuation must continually prove its subordination to life value.
This also restructures development and global health. To escape the Trojan horse and Hydra traps, global development must focus on cultivating genuine, autonomous local capacity rather than expanding the market reach of foreign corporations disguised as aid.
And global health must pivot from managing the lucrative symptoms of disease to dismantling the systemic source patterns of illness, the poverty, the toxic supply chains, the exploitative labor conditions.
The sheer scale of this vision is breathtaking. Imagine a United Nations summit where, before any treaty is drafted, the delegates spend days applying the recursive audit to their definitions of growth, peace, and security.
But I have to push back hard against the practical reality of this.
Go ahead.
We are talking about dismantling the ideological foundations of global finance, the military-industrial complex, and massive corporate monopolies. These systems are ruthlessly, perfectly designed to conserve their own power. If we perform the audit and declare them life incoherent, they are not going to experience a sudden moral awakening and voluntarily step down.
It is the most critical question of application. How do you intervene in a highly resistant, deeply entrenched, violently defended system without becoming a dictator yourself?
Because if your strategy is to violently force life coherence onto the world, you immediately contradict the foundational premise of life coherence. Living systems cannot be instructed or programmed from the outside like a piece of software.
This tension brings us to the final and perhaps most challenging section of the paper, non-forcing action and the biology of love. How do we act in the face of profound resistance?
Dr. Sadley introduces the ancient Taoist concept of Wu Wei, often translated as non-forcing action. It is essential to clarify that Wu Wei does not mean passivity.
No, it is not an excuse to sit on the sidelines and meditate while extractive systems consume the biosphere. It is a highly disciplined, skillful mode of participation.
I think the best way to understand the mechanics of this is through an analogy. Imagine you have a flower bud that hasn't opened yet. Your goal is for the flower to bloom. Forcing action would be taking your fingers, grabbing the closed petals, and physically ripping them open. You achieve the mechanical goal of opening the flower, but you destroy the biological life of the flower in the process. Your intervention killed the subject.
The method destroyed the mission.
Right. Non-forcing action, Wu Wei, means you turn your attention to the structural couplings. You tend to the soil. You adjust the pH balance. You ensure adequate water. You remove barriers blocking the sunlight. You cultivate the precise environmental conditions in which the flower possesses the autonomous capacity to open itself.
We must relinquish the desire to force life into coherence. We must instead dedicate our energy to cultivating the conditions where life can recover its own coherence.
When we encounter systemic resistance, forcing action treats that resistance as an enemy obstacle that must be violently crushed.
Non-forcing action treats resistance as vital diagnostic information. It asks, why is this institution resisting? What deep-seated fear is being conserved here? What historical relationship is broken?
Forcing action demands compliance through coercion. Non-forcing action seeks metanoia, a fundamental internal conversion in how a system sees and values the world.
But practically speaking, how do you cultivate conditions for metanoia when the people on the other side of the conflict are actively causing catastrophic harm? When a corporation is actively poisoning a water supply, tending the soil around them feels entirely inadequate.
This is where the paper reintroduces Humberto Maturana, specifically his concept of the biology of love. In Maturana's framework, love is not a romantic sentiment or a squishy, naive emotion. It is a rigorous, biological, relational domain.
Love occurs when you interact with another being in a way that allows them to appear as a legitimate other in coexistence with you.
Meaning you absolutely refuse to erase their humanity even while you are engaged in fierce opposition against them.
The guiding maxim of this entire philosophy is you must oppose the life-destroying pattern without denying the living being trapped inside that pattern.
Which is the exact opposite of how modern political and social movements operate. Our entire mechanism for organizing action is based on enemy making. We build solidarity by mutually agreeing on who we hate. We reduce the human beings inside opposing systems to disposable, two-dimensional embodiments of evil.
And the paper warns that building a corrective movement upon the emotional ground of enemy making is a guarantee of structural failure. If your movement requires the negation of the other, you are actively laying the groundwork for the next golden calf trap.
You will inevitably become the monster you are trying to defeat.
You can and must dismantle destructive institutions. You must restrain violence. You must build barricades against extraction. But the moment you strip the humanity from the people enforcing those systems, your corrective movement is no longer life coherent. It has been captured by the emotional domain of domination.
Let's apply this to a real-world scenario. A forcing intervention would look like a massive, top-down, state-mandated green energy project. The state decides a specific valley is perfect for a massive hydroelectric dam to lower carbon emissions. They forcibly displace the indigenous community living there, claiming it is a necessary sacrifice for the greater planetary good.
The intervention satisfies the Procrustean metric of carbon reduction, but it violently destroys the living relation.
A non-forcing intervention addressing the exact same crisis operates entirely differently. It begins by engaging that local community as legitimate others in coexistence. It asks what capacities they are currently missing. It seeks to understand their fears regarding the changing climate.
It offers resources and structural support to empower their own autonomous transition toward ecological stability. It is undeniably slower, it is vastly more complex and frustrating, but it is the only method that does not leave a trail of structural violence in its wake.
We have journeyed through an immense and challenging landscape today. We started by defining the insidious nature of corrective capture, the gravity that pulls our best solutions toward institutional self-preservation.
We unpacked Maturana's insight that every distinction we make brings forth a specific reality driven by our underlying emotional state.
We examine the terrifying mechanics of the mythic traps. Procrustes amputating reality to fit the spreadsheet. Cassandra silenced by systemic inertia.
The Hydra and Sisyphus keeping us trapped in endless, ineffectual institutional motion.
And the ultimate danger of the golden calf, where the purity of our doctrine becomes more important than the cries of the wounded world.
We laid out the rigorous, uncomfortable practice of the recursive life coherence audit, teaching ourselves to constantly ask who loses voice and what violence is justified by our brilliant ideas.
And finally, we confronted the immense discipline of non-forcing action and the biology of love, the realization that we cannot beat the world into submission. We can only cultivate the conditions for its healing.
It is a radical restructuring of how we observe the world and how we observe ourselves observing.
And that is exactly where we want to leave you, the listener. Because distinction hygiene and life coherence are not just academic theories meant to be debated at planetary governance summits. They are disciplines of the observer.
And you are the observer.
Before any of us can attempt to repair the civilizational crises out there, we have to relentlessly interrogate the emotional ground we are acting from in here. Are we genuinely seeking repair? Or are we secretly seeking the comfort of superiority and control?
The true work begins when the observer becomes observable to themselves.
Which leaves me with one final, deeply uncomfortable thought for you to carry into your week. Every single one of us has a corrective idea that we hold sacred. It's that one political cure, that one economic fix, that specific moral framework we are fiercely, absolutely certain about, the one we use to judge the ignorance of others. What if the most radical, world-changing action you can take today isn't to go out and acquire a new piece of information? What if, instead, you take the idea you're most fiercely certain about and subject it to the recursive audit? Who is losing their voice when you enforce it? What subtle violences are you justifying in its name? What would you actually do if you discovered that your absolute favorite cure for the world had silently, without you even noticing, become a golden calf? Keep diving deep.